Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McCallan. Bello Miguel Cipriani is a blind author. He writes non-fictional and short fictional works. Bello recently published a book titled Blind, a Memoir. The story takes readers on Bello's profound journey into blindness. Bello's journey begins when he's robbed of his sight at the hands of his childhood friends, and he continues with his story as a blind man, seeking lifelong independence. Bello joins us in the studio to talk about that journey. Hi, Bello.
Hi, Brian.
How you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I want to first say that as a visually impaired person myself who struggles with independence, I found your book quite inspirational. Now, just so that our listeners learn a little background about you and your story, how were you robbed of your sight?
Back in 2007, I was assaulted. And basically, I was kicked in the head so many times that my retina is detached. So that was the cause of my blindness. The people who were the attackers were people who I've known from my childhood. They were at one point my best friends. And so it was not just emotionally stressful and physically stressful, but it was a bit, you know, there was definitely a sense of betrayal when this whole event happened.
They really must have betrayed your trust.
Correct.
I understand that there was a criminal case filed against your friends, and there was also a civil suit as well. Now, the criminal case, from reading your book, it was dropped due to insufficient evidence. However, there was a civil suit filed against your assailants, and you were awarded some compensation. How did the criminal case and civil suit provide closure to the assault?
It was very much almost like a chore to deal with the legalities of my, you know, both the criminal and the civil cases, you know, taking time away to, you know, go to depositions, attend, you know, meetings with my attorney. So once the, you know, both came to an end, it was almost like a sense of relief, meaning that I could put this behind me and move on to the next phase of my life. I think it allowed me to just make my situation more concrete, and it was very almost like a blessing to just be able to just move on and put it behind me.
Yeah, so it was a crazy process. Do you think there will be ever any chance that criminal charges will be filed again?
You know, I'm not an attorney. You know, I think that at this point, I'm content with how things played out, just in the sense that, you know, everything got handled. You know, of course, I went through a phase where I feel like there was injustice, but at the same time, you know, I feel that, you know, the way things played out were the way things had to happen for me.
Yeah. It just turned out that way. Just out of curiosity, how's your vision today?
My vision right now, I'm a total, and so I have no light perception. I still produce tears. I think my eyes are functional. Generally speaking, I could still move them. I haven't had any pain. You know, I've been told by doctors that, you know, in the future, if I start getting pain from my eyes, they could possibly be removed. As of right now, my eyes are just functioning, you know, producing tears and, you know, still able to, the anatomy is healthy.
Okay. Now that would mean an eye transplant, right?
I think what they mentioned is that, you know, with my case, because I had a lot of trauma with my eyes, that, you know, if I start getting too much pain, it would probably be best to have them removed and that I would have prosthetics.
Let's now talk more about your great book and your desire for telling your story. Why did you decide to write Blind, a Memoir?
I've always been an avid reader. Yeah, even before I lost my sight, I was always, you know, reading books, spending time at bookstores. And, you know, I always sought comfort in books. I felt that whenever I was going through a particular period of time in my life, I could always find a book to help me understand it or deal with it better. When I lost my sight, I wanted to look for books about, you know, adults losing vision. And I found many wonderful books about blind people doing amazing things. However, the books about adults losing vision weren't that many. There was only about a handful, and most of them, you know, were not recent publications. So I felt like there was really a need to depict a more contemporary view of blindness, let people know that we are using GPS, that we are text messaging, that we have all these great tools available to us.
Yeah, I also did my own web search and found that, yeah, there are few memoirs published out there by blind people about their blindness. I was looking on the web, and I noticed that one author, Stephen Cusisto, who teaches English in Iowa City, Iowa, wrote Planet of the Blind, and none other than the great Helen Keller wrote The Story of My Life. How is your story different from these other inspirational stories about blind people?
There's a couple other books. I mean, Stephen Cusisto, I mean, he was born with a visual impairment. So his memoir really deals with what it's like to have limited vision and how that affects him. And there is definitely a sense of denial as he was younger. I mean, he didn't accept his own blindness until he was in his 30s. I think he got his guide dog at 39, which is it's a different journey. There are other books, for example, Susan Krieger, who's a professor at Stanford, she has a book called Things No Longer There that also deals with losing sight. And there's another book called Do You Remember the Color Blue? And all these books, you know, just show aspects of blindness. How my book differs is that mine really deals with what some people may consider mundane, everyday things. But I think that those are the items that people are most curious about. People always want to know, hey, how do you guys cook? How do blind people select their clothing? And, you know, I focus on some of the very minor details. Hey, you know, I had to put, you know, bump dots on my microwave to be able to use it. I had to, you know, have a color identifier. I used the computer by doing this. And I did that by showing my journey of learning adaptive technology.
You use adaptive technology to write, correct?
Yes, I do.
What kind? What are the programs?
I'm using JAWS for my screen reader. And I also use a talking dictionary, the Franklin device. You know, I'm not able to take notes. I tried using the Slate and Stylus to take Braille notes. It just wasn't working out for me. I just went back to a digital recorder. And if I ever get an idea, I make sure I capture it by using my recorder. And so it's a combination of, you know, my computer, my laptop, my recorder where I store notes, and my talking dictionary.
Okay, so in your book, you talk about the various types of people living in the blind world. The super blind people, the super blind people are those with extraordinary abilities. Now, I'm not speaking of Superman, Daredevil, or any of those DC Comics superheroes, but you talk about the guy who climbed Mount Everest. And you also talk about the whiners. Of course, you're not a whiner, but they're those who use their blindness as an excuse to get out of doing anything, and they were spoiled rotten by their families. But how in the book do you try to inspire those people in that group of whiners to consider joining the group of super blind people?
I think that for me it was very important to show that I was a member of that group. I mean, I think that initially I saw blindness as the most, you know, a huge obstacle. And I feel that I made the transition from not trusting, you know, my cane, not trusting people, not trusting even my service dog at the beginning, and showing that there is a long journey between trust and trusting yourself. And I think that's what maybe is holding back many people who, you know, choose to live a very isolated life. You know, it's they're afraid of venturing out, and that's a fear that I had. And I think that with my book, I want to show people that I was a part of this group. I was afraid. I did use my blindness as an excuse, but eventually I learned to shed that coat of fear, and then eventually started trusting in myself.
I have some friends who didn't have that much either in their lives, and who even had who were also visually impaired, but they had also experienced some hardships, and they've also done what you have done, Bello, you know, done their own little creative works just to help them move on with their lives. Throughout the book, You chronicle your road to independence from Living Skills and getting all the orientation and mobility training you needed to even getting a new job at Magley and Associates. Who's Magley and Associates, by the way?
Magley and Associates, it's a consulting firm here in San Francisco. They're still around. It's owned by Susan Magley, and it's a boutique firm, and they offer staff augmentation services for both IT and marketing and HR professionals. And they're a wonderful company. I mean, I have nothing but great things to say about them. And I think they were so wonderful to welcome me into the workforce and really be patient with me as I acclimated to this new aspect of being working and blind.
That's good. That's good. Good for you. So you also got a new job, and you also got some guide dog training and your new guide dog, Madge, who's actually right here in the studio.
She is. She's a very petite lab. Most people still think she's a puppy. She's about 40 pounds and 19 inches, and it's the, you know, what I call a compact dog. Works great in the city. You know, she fits under the seats in Muni and BART. And, you know, sometimes we're, you know, I was walking in this place where there was glass and I just picked her up. I don't want you walking there, you know. So I think she's a great size. And definitely the training was very intense. And it definitely tested, you know, parts of myself that I don't think I've ever been tested before.
Now, speaking of that intense training, what training did you find the most valuable?
I think the guide dog training was very valuable because someone who was a victim of a violent crime, I tend to, you know, sometimes struggle with trusting strangers. And as a blind person, you find yourself trusting strangers all the time. And even something very small, with when they offer help, you have to grab their arm and you're touching, you're having interaction with somebody who you don't know anything about. And so I think the guide dog training really allowed me to just let go of some of those fears by allowing me to trust a dog with my life. I think that was the trust, you know, interdependency was something that, you know, I really learned to understand once I had a guide dog.
The guide dog not only helped you become more independent, but it also helped you just gain a new friend.
Absolutely.
So, what are your future plans in your lifelong quest for full independence?
You know, I have a lot of irons in the fire right now. I'm still writing. I'm working on a second book. I'm currently at a fellowship at UCLA. It's called the Lambda Literary Fellowship, and that was the goal for that fellowship, was to build the skeleton for my second book. So I definitely see myself, you know, continue to write. Long term, you know, I would like to go into teaching at a university level, and I'm working towards, you know, that as well as we speak, you know, filling out applications for doctoral programs and, you know, attending conferences and all that stuff that goes along with academia. And as far as independence, I feel that I'm up to date with what's, you know, with technology, and I think that's something that's always going to be changing, and I hope to keep, you know, just embracing the technology that comes along.
So you actually went for your master's in creative writing at Notre Dame de Namur University in Belmont, California, and is that the place where you actually first got the idea for writing this book?
Yes. Correct. You know, I've always been into science fiction, and so initially I started writing, you know, short fiction pieces, and I had a class where we were writing personal essays, and I wrote a personal essay, and, you know, when my teacher read it, she says, "This is a book. This should be your project," and that's kind of how this all, the you know, Blinded Memoir came about, was through my graduate coursework and talking to instructors and really isolating the ideas that I had for this book.
Now, let's talk more about the content and structure of your book. Let's first talk about the chapters. Mm-hmm. I hear you've got a favorite. What is your favorite chapter and why?
My favorite chapter is traffic. And it's really hard for any author to pick a chapter that they like, you know, but for me, traffic really stands out because it's one of those chapters that I started writing, you know, and when you're in school and you're taking writing classes, they tell just to write. And so I was wanted to, you know, keep with the theme of the guide dog school. And I started writing, and it wasn't until I finished the last sentence of that chapter that I realized that it was fear that had been holding me back the first 2 weeks from bonding with my guide dog. And it's very interesting when you could see yourself in your writing and learn from yourself. And that was definitely one of those moments where I wrote it out, and it wasn't until I started reading it back to me where I realized, oh my God, I had been afraid the whole time.
Oh, wow. So I also heard that there was one tough chapter to write. What was that chapter? And why was it a challenge?
The first chapter, the siren song, that was definitely very tough. It took me a while to write it down. The reason for that was that, you know, when you write nonfiction, you try to put yourself in that place again. And some people do it differently. You know, for example, if I want to write about my childhood, I listen to the songs that my mom played in the radio when I was young, and that helped me put myself back in that situation. With the siren song, I had to put myself back in a situation of pain and frustration and anger and shock and denial and basically mourning. And so it was very challenging, and I had to do it, you know, bit by bit. And I think it was probably the last chapter I completed in the book.
Two of your chapter titles are called Braille Jail and Super Blind and Traffic and even Quack. How did you decide to create these group references or terms for these chapters and other chapter titles in your book?
I think for in general, I you know, I tend to let my emotions guide my words. And I think that when I wrote the Braille Jail, I think I really felt like I was, you know, in prison. You know, I was at this facility where I was spending time, and I had to, you know, complete the time, the sentence that was given to me. And, you know, Braille just was very challenging for me at the beginning, and it definitely felt like a sentence. So that's where that came from. I think, you know, all the other chapters are just, you know, the feelings I was experiencing at the time. Super Blind just came to me just because it seemed that just in my interaction with society in the Bay Area, people expected these supernatural abilities of me, and that's often what's portrayed in the media. You see blind people who are, you know, have powers or who have, you know, abilities that are just not common, you know? And so there was definitely a superhero theme to it. You know, I grew up reading comics too, so that influences a lot of my writing. Is I grew up reading comics, I love science fiction, and so all those came together. I feel that when I was adjusting to blindness, I almost felt like I was going through a second adolescence, and it reminded me a lot of, you know, these superheroes who are new into their powers and they're still trying to figure them out. And that's kind of the theme that I had for Super Blind, where it's, you know, it's a, you know, a mutant just came into his powers, and I'm totally going to X-Men here. But, you know, and they often don't know how to use him at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the feeling that I had when I wrote that chapter.
Yep. That helps actually get the people to picture themselves, even the blind people, as being those superheroes and going, okay, I've got the powers, I can do this.
Definitely. And I think that for me, it helped to, you know, add a little humor to it. You know, I think it was easier to accept some of the challenges when I could just laugh it off. And I think that, you know, treating myself like, you know, someone coming into their powers was just kind of like fun, you know. And, you know, again, I always expected my hearing to really improve, and it really hasn't. I think it's like the same. But I think that my sense of smell definitely got more acute, and so did my sense of taste, because both my taste for cologne changed, and my taste for food has changed too.
Mm-hmm. So the book's cover shows San Francisco's tall city buildings lit up at night, like the skyline shots with the view from below looking up. and there are also streaks of light on the road with no visible cars, as what you get from a long-time film exposure. How did you pick this cover for your book?
I was very lucky that I was working with this amazing firm, Monkey C Media, designed my cover, and they just did an amazing job. So I basically sat with them and told them my ideas. I definitely wanted a cityscape on my cover. I didn't want it to be dark, though. And so they gave me a whole bunch of different cover ideas, and I forwarded it to a bunch of friends. And it was through that, that process that I came through this cover. And I really wanted something to deal with, with it being timeless. And I think that's where the colors come into place, where it shows, a time and a place, but it's hard to tell when it happened.
Okay. Harry Potter, Twilight, and other novels, plays, and series, they've been adapted into top-rated box office hits. Do you think Blind, a Memoir, is going to ever get up to those ranks?
I think I could always hope and wish, right? And hope for the best. I mean, I would be open to it. I did my audiobook, recently, and just that experience was so much fun, selecting the actor to do my voice. It was a little strange to have, 10 to 20 actors reenact parts of my life. I felt like an SNL skit. But it was fun too, and picking the music. So that allowed me to really look at all these other forms of media as potential great projects.
Did you pick a famous actor, a famous one that everyone knows for the audiobook?
The audiobook is read by Sean Crisden, and he has a lot of credits. He's done a lot of video games, TV commercials. I like the fact that, I like his voice. People often say, oh, he doesn't sound like you, and, but I think that I think he did a good job. What made my selection... What was crucial for me was, there's three languages that are part of my book. There's Spanish, Portuguese, and English. And I wanted someone who could pronunciate all three correctly. And so I would find people who spoke perfect English, who their Spanish was great, but when they got to the Portuguese, it wasn't what I expected. And so I'm a native Portuguese, speaker, and English as well. And Spanish, I learned them all at the same time.
I'm half Portuguese myself.
Oh, okay. And so... I really wanted all three languages to be, treated the best possible. And he was able to, say capoeira and mestre and vaguinho in Portuguese, and also say perro in Spanish and Marisa, and his English was also very well enunciated. So that was definitely what made, in my mind, him the perfect guy.
Now, capoeira, you actually practice that, and I hear it's a Brazilian martial art. How is that different from karate or mixed martial arts that most people probably watch on Spike?
Yeah, well, capoeira is an Afro-Brazilian martial art, and it's one of the few martial arts in the world that does not have an Asian lineage. And it was developed during Brazil's slavery period. Runaway slaves developed this combat form, they disguised as a dance, so they were able to practice it without their the slave owners knowing. So to the slave owners, they were just dancing, but in reality, they were practicing this very powerful martial art, which is now it's now Brazil's national sport. I still practice martial art. I train in Berkeley with Mr. Accordion, and I actually have a documentary coming out where I show people how blind people can do capoeira. It'll be showcased in the Berno Heights Outdoor Cinema, which is at the end of August here in San Francisco. And my reason for putting that movie together is, again, I feel that people often respond more to something visual, right? And so when I lost my sight and I wanted to go back to train, a lot of schools were hesitant. They wanted me to do either private instruction, which was too expensive, or they said, oh, we don't have the ability to train you right now. And I finally found a school that trained me. And so I wanted to put this video together just so people could see that blind people are able to do this martial art. And that's kind of my goal with many of the projects I do. I mean, I consider myself a writer, but I find myself doing, you know, this documentary about martial arts or doing other things that are not relevant to writing just because I want, you know, well, first of all, because they're fun, you know, and second of all, I want people to, you know, have different perceptions of blindness. You know, blind people can do sports. They can do comedy. You know, they can do poetry readings and they can dance, you know. So I did a spread with Compete magazine, which is a sports magazine. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to show them, hey, you know, blind people can do sports too. So that's just kind of my stance on that I feel that we have a lot of blind people that are doing amazing things. We often don't get the coverage in the media. I really wish there was a blind news anchor. You know, I really wish there was, you know, a blind MC or just more people on television doing notable things.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe like me, perhaps.
Yes.
But so you, on the front, let's actually talk about Wheatmark, who mm-hmm. was your publisher for your book out of Arizona. They have a concierge service. In the publishing world, this is what is a concierge service?
What I meant by that is, you know, I wanted to be with a company that's going to take all my needs very seriously, you know, and I talked to many presses. I talked to some big, you know, printing houses, and I felt that, you know, my needs were not met. You know, many of the big publishers would not create an audiobook until I became a bestseller. And that was definitely a deal breaker for me. Wheatmark did everything possible to make my book as accessible. Every part of my book, you know, the design was, you know, made with the blind community in mind. For example, we picked a font that works well with CCTVs and magnifiers. We picked the size of the book and the fact that it's a paperback. You know, paperbacks are easier to scan if people are using OpenBook or any other, you know, scanning software.
Okay, Bello, we're almost running out of time, but where can listeners buy your book, and what's the best way for the blind and visually impaired to read it?
My book could be purchased through any major online retailer, both the audiobook and the ebook and the paperback. Audiobooks can be purchased through Audible and iTunes, and, you know, you could get the Daisy file in Braille versions from Bookshare.org.
Okay, so definitely check out those sites. Well, we're running out of time, but thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Next time, we'll talk with a blind explorer about his upcoming expedition. Thanks for listening, and remember to speak out.